You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's Friday, and if it's Friday, that means it's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. The man I think of as America's senator. The people of Vermont know that he's theirs and are very proud of it. And his website, sanders.senate.gov. Bernie, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Welcome back to your program. I think of this hour as your hour, as Bernie's hour. Oligarchy. I wanted to ask you about this. This is a word that probably a lot of Americans don't even understand what it means. You know, they've just heard of things like, you know, oh, the Chinese oligarchs or the Russian oligarchs or the Brazilian Mexican, you know, Carlos Slim. He's a Mexican oligarch.
Well, it's a word that, in fact, we should become more familiar with because, in fact, America is becoming, to a significant degree, an oligarchy or a plutocracy or call it what you want. But I think when we look at what's happening in America today, if you look at the growing wealth and income inequality in this country, if you look at the fact that the United States has the most unfair distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth, and it's getting worse. I think if you look at the fact that you have the top 1% earning more income than the bottom 50%, and you got the 400, this is really a wild statistic and true statistic, the 400 wealthiest people in this country own more wealth than the bottom half of America, 150 million people. And then there was a study just came out from a fellow named Saez, S-A-E-Z, from the University of California a few weeks ago. And he studied income tax returns from 2009 and 2010. And what he discovered, and this is also literally beyond belief, is that 93% of all of the new income created in 2010 compared to 2009 went to the top 1%. So all the new income went to the people at the very, very top. And on the other hand, you have tens of millions of people in the middle class of this country who are struggling every single day to pay their mortgages or their rent or heat their homes or send their kids to college, take care of the basic necessities of life. And what an oligarchy speaks to is a situation where a small number of people, i.e. the top 1% or whatever, own and control to a very significant degree the economic and political life of the nation. And I think it's fair to say that in many ways that is where we are moving to. So economically, we already have this extraordinarily unequal distribution of wealth and income, which is getting worse. You have our friends in the Republican Party who are resisting even modest tax reform, i.e. the Buffett rule, which says that maybe it's a little bit crazy that you have millionaires and billionaires, people like Warren Buffett, who pay an effective real tax rate that's lower than middle-class people. Maybe that's wrong with Republicans. I don't think we got one Republican. We did get one Republican vote to deal with that issue. And where you have corporations today, large corporations, making billions in profits, in some cases paying nothing in federal income taxes. So economically, you have a situation where very few people have significant control over the economy, own much of the wealth and income of the nation. And then when you look at what's going on politically, especially since Citizens United, you now have a situation where these very same people, billionaires, Koch brothers and others, are able to spend unlimited sums of money without disclosure on the political process. And what that means is not just what we're seeing saw in the Republican primary, and certainly we'll see in the general election. It's taking place in states like Ohio right now, where Senator Sherrod Brown is being hit with, I believe, something like $5 million of third-party ads. And this is 6 months left to go in the election.
Right.
Other people are seeing these type of activities. And you have folks like Sheldon Adelson. This is a guy who's worth $22 billion. If he and his wife give $5 million each to Newt Gingrich, and I don't know who they'll be giving money to in the future, you know what that is, Tom? That is one day of profits for them.
Wow.
One day of profits. So if you're a multi-billionaire and you're interested in politics and you want to see more tax breaks for the rich, more deregulation of Wall Street, whatever it is, if you're a multi-billionaire, you know, putting $20, $30, $50 million into a campaign is nothing. And it's a good investment for you. And now that Citizens United has given these corporations the right to take money right out of their own treasuries, is just going to make this situation even more and more outrageous. What I do want to mention to you is that we had just a couple of days ago a very good meeting in D.C. In which Senator Tom Udall, Senator Chuck Schumer, and I spoke. We had Ted Deutsch, we had John Conyers, a number of the best people in the Congress were there, the House, talking about the need for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. We have introduced such an amendment. Udall has. We have, I think, well over 200,000 signatures on a petition in supporting a constitutional amendment on our website. Love to have even more if people want to go to our website to do that. So that was a good meeting, and it's enormously important that we focus on getting this kind of corporate money out of politics. Very proud that in my own state, early March at our town meeting days, we had 65 towns vote in support of a constitutional amendment, and just in the last week or two, we had a Vermont State Senate, Vermont State House of Representatives, they passed resolutions in support of a constitutional amendment joining New Mexico and Hawaii. And I would hope listeners would get their local governing bodies, their city councils or whatever, involved in this issue, get their state legislatures involved in this issue, because we're going to need a strong grassroots movement that says corporations are not people, that we are destroying American democracy when we allow these big money interests to flood the airwaves with TV ads. So that's an issue we are working hard on. I think we're making some progress, and we've just got to keep the pressure up.
Yeah. And the post office, how's the post office doing?
Well, this is an issue, as you know, we've talked about it many, many times on this show. It's an issue I feel very, very strongly about. And I think while we're not, you know, accomplishing everything that I want, we are making some progress. And there will be a vote, I suspect, Tuesday or Wednesday of next week, which I hope very much, you know, one can never predict will pass, which will go a long way, in preventing the Postmaster General from doing what he originally had wanted to do, which is to shut down or to look at the shutdown of some, 3,700 rural post offices. And for those of us in rural states, we know what a disaster that would be. I think he has come a long way on that. This legislation would provide very strong safeguards and protections to post offices before they could shut down. This legislation would decrease the number of processing plants that would be shut down. This legislation begins to address the fact that every single year the post office is forced to put $5.5 billion into a future employee retirement health program. Many of us believe that's no longer necessary. The program has $44 billion in it already, and we addressed to some degree that issue in this legislation. Postmaster General wanted to end Saturday mail delivery. That is delayed for at least 2 years. And also, in the midst of this terrible recession, we will prevent the kind of huge job loss that was originally contemplated. So it doesn't do everything that I want to do, but I think it's a step forward. We're going to have a number of very, very good amendments coming up on Tuesday and Wednesday. I would hope that the listeners would urge their senators to support the strongest legislation possible to protect the Postal Service.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, 15 minutes past the hour. Your opportunity to talk with Senator Sanders in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for his newsletter. It's a great news resource, and you can sign his constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can drop by our website, too, at tomhartman.com. You can get our free iPhone app, our iPad app. You can drop into our free live chat room, make your own blogs, participate in our message boards, all kinds of cool stuff.
No matter what you say, what you do, you got me hooked, I'm here to stay.
Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And Bernie, Sam from Point Pleasant, West Virginia, was just asking the question. He pointed out that his grandfather, who was born in 1895, was a postal carrier. in West Virginia, and it was a really important thing to be a, it was a big deal to be a postal carrier, and it was really important to all the people out in the hollers and the rural areas.
No, and Sam hit it right on the head. And I want to thank Sam for calling. We sometimes take for granted the Postal Service. Just take it for granted. It's always been there, and we see it every day. But what Sam is talking about is that in many rural areas in the country, historically and today, the Postal Service means that you're going to be able to get communications, you'll be able to get letters, you'll be able to get packages and mail, no matter where you live. That's a pretty big deal. We take it for granted, but that's a pretty big deal. And that's because you got mailmen who are going up dirt roads and making those deliveries in some of the most rural areas of this country. What also we forget about is that the Postal Service is vitally important to millions and millions of people who are involved in small businesses whose jobs depend upon getting packages out every day and having good and prompt and reasonably priced service, that what they send out gets to their destination on time and at a reasonable cost. And that's what the Postal Service does. The debate that we are having now is, yes, we all acknowledge that email and the Internet has certainly impacted the Postal Service. But we believe the Postal Service can adopt a new business model, which makes it aggressive, that gives many of our post offices flexibility to start selling new products, providing new services. I would give an example, and, you know, Sam would probably back me up, that in rural West Virginia, where people may want to get a hunting license or a fishing license, you can't get that from a post office. You can't get your applications for a driver's license at a post office. You can't get gifts wrapped at a post office. You can't get letters notarized at a post office. If we provide more flexibility for the post office, we think more revenue will be able to come in. Last point that Sam touched about is in a sense, you know, how far right-wing many of our Republican conservative friends are. And let's not underestimate what these guys want to do. Many of them, I won't say all of them, but there are a significant number of them who really believe in their heart of hearts, not just that you want to cut Social Security or cut Medicare or cut Medicaid, for example. They believe those programs are unconstitutional. They believe that the federal government should not be involved in health care or in Social Security, and some of them believe in public education as well. And at the end of all of their rhetoric about so-called freedom and getting the government off of our backs, what they are really talking about in their heart of hearts is returning back to the 1920s or earlier, where working people had very little security, no health care benefits, no rights on the job, no worker protection, no rights to organize a union, worker safety legislation, no minimum wage legislation. These guys, some of them really want to repeal all of that and bring us back to a time when a few people with incredible wealth and power, i.e. an oligarchy, was able to control everything that happened in America, and working people had virtually nothing. And that is the struggle that we're in right now. And it's a struggle that we had better win if this country is going to survive with any level of dignity for working people.
James in Wooden Farms, Illinois, listening on Chicago's Progressive Talk. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. James?
Yes, hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Big show of the fan, Bernie. I think you're great, Tom. You're awesome. First, I want to make a statement of why we are where we are today, and then I want to follow with two questions. If you look back throughout history, everything and our entire economic system is based off the utilization of energy, and through the advent of technology, we can now produce more than we can consume with less man hours. I'm 26 years old. I dropped out of my bachelor's degree in economics and finance to pursue an associate's degree in renewable energy. So now I got 2 degrees. I work on a wind farm for one of the largest corporations in the world. I see a lot of students a lot of people in my generation graduating from college with mortgage-sized debts, but they have no asset. So therefore, they're indentured servants to this perpetual debt society. and they can't find jobs.
So your question is, for Bernie, yes.
Right, exactly. So what I was following through, my question is, what is the government planning on doing for the future of my generation as far as where are the jobs at and what's going to happen with my generation? I see a lot of my generation struggling. Where are we going to be at in 20 years?
Okay, James, great question, and congratulations for working in sustainable energy. There are very few issues more important than transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy, such as wind. And I gather you're working on a wind farm, and that's fantastic. James asks, he's 26, and he asked about the future of his generation, and that is, man, that is a real, real question. And what I will tell you, James, unless we get our act together and start creating an economy that works for working people in this country rather than the super rich, your generation, I hesitate to tell you this, but this is the truth, will for the first time in the modern history of America have a lower standard of living than your parents. In other words, we are seeing the dissipation, the end of the American dream, where parents worked hard so their kids could do better. If we don't turn this economy around, the kids are going to do worse than their parents. Now, yes, should we pick this up after the break?
Sure, we can do that. Thanks. Thank you, Bernie. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. And you can check out Bernie's website. He has a proposed constitutional amendment to repeal Citizens United. You can sign on for that. You get his newsletter, the Bernie Buzz, all the information of the day, all the news of the day at sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can drop by TomHartman.com for all the cool stuff there that is all, with the exception of the podcast, everything is totally free. Have fun.
Do you love?
Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. And, Bernie, you were just wrapping up a topic.
Well, James asked a good question, I think, and he's reflecting the views of just millions of people in his generation. He's worried about the future of this country and what happens to his generation being a young man of 26. Well, I would say to James that clearly you're absolutely right. Many young people in this country are leaving school deeply in debt. And we have to deal with the issue of student debt. One of the things we certainly want to do is make sure that it is not doubled. The interest rates on student debt are not doubled, as they will be if Congress doesn't act. So we got to deal with that immediately. Kids already have crushing debts out there. We don't want to make that worse. Second of all, in terms of jobs, one area that I see huge potential in is that right now, as we try to address the horrors of global warming, we are spending hundreds of billions of dollars every single year importing oil from countries all over the earth, many of whom are not particularly friendly to us. If you take a fraction of that money and start investing that in energy efficiency and sustainable energy, we can create a significant number of good-paying jobs, cut greenhouse gas emissions, save people money on their fuel bills, move toward energy independence. So, James, I think that's an area that we definitely should move in, and that's the area you're already working in. So I want to see a lot more people working in that area. I think there's also huge opportunity for job creation at all levels, rebuilding our infrastructure, roads, bridges, wastewater plants, water systems, airports, schools. We need everybody from blue-collar manual laborers, construction workers, to architects and engineers to do that. Somebody in my office just came back from China and was just blown away by the kinds of investment they're making in high-speed rail, in broadband, cell phone service. They are investing a lot more than we are. We can create jobs in a significant way by rebuilding our infrastructure. And thirdly, I think, as Tom and I have talked about on many occasions, we need to change our trade policies so that corporate America is investing in the United States of America, not China, not Vietnam, et cetera. We've got to rebuild that manufacturing sector and understand that we can't survive economically when we have lost almost 60,000 factories in the last 10 years and millions of good-paying manufacturing jobs. So those are some of the areas, James, that I think we've got to work on to create the jobs that your generation needs.
Michael in Seattle, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator Sanders and Tom. I have two quick questions. The first is, President Obama ran promising to raise the federal minimum wage, which is now $7.25 an hour. Well, since he's been in office, it stayed frozen at $7.25 an hour, which is abysmal. It happens to be wildly popular, raising it, and the right thing to do. Two, the highway bill passed, speaking of creating millions of new jobs, with 72 votes, almost unheard of these days, strong bipartisan support.
72% of the Senate.
No, it was actually 74 votes.
And I've read it would create 1.9 desperately needed jobs to repair our antiquated, dilapidated, and dangerous infrastructure. It hasn't gone anywhere. It hasn't even come up for a vote in the House. It's just languished. So
well,
there's
thank you, Michael,
questions.
Thanks for raising that issue, because you're right on both counts. Let me deal with the transportation bill, because I'm on the transportation committee.
Hmm.
We had a bill which was a two-year bill, which in fact in the Senate brought together one of the most conservative members of the Senate, a fellow named Jim Inhofe from Oklahoma, and one of the more progressive members, Barbara Boxer of California, and they worked really hard. And they came up with a bill that didn't go as far as I would like to go, but as Michael indicates, it was a serious bill, which would begin the process of rebuilding roads, bridges, and public transit. Strong bipartisan support in the Senate, 74 votes, half the Republicans, almost all the Democrats. We sent it to the House, and these guys, you know, just hard to imagine where their head is. Everybody knows that our infrastructure is crumbling. Everybody knows that in the middle of a recession, the fastest way to create decent-paying jobs is to rebuild the infrastructure, and they don't want to do it. They do not want to invest in America. And sometimes you think that maybe these guys really do want us to become a third world country and fall way behind China. But in any case, Michael is exactly right. That bill went over to the House. I'm not quite sure where it is right now, but they certainly have not moved on it. And as you come closer and closer to summer, this is when construction takes place. And you can't, the company can't turn these contracts around in days. They need time to plan them. So what the delay in the House means is that we are already losing a whole lot of jobs, and I certainly hope they get their act together. The other point Michael makes is about raising the minimum wage. He's right. I suspect what Obama understands is that will go no place again in the Republican House. You have guys there who are talking about doing away with the concept of minimum wage, who think that it would be okay in America if you had workers working for $3 or $4 an hour. So that's kind of where we are in that, Michael.
Joe in Augusta, Georgia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hello, Senator. A few moments ago, you had said that all the entitlement programs, such as Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, were all constitutional. I was going to ask you, where in the Constitution does it empower the federal government to do all of those powers, all of those things?
Joe, it does in the General Welfare Clause that the Congress has the power. I forgot the exact words. Maybe you have them, Tom.
It's Article 1, Section 8. Within a minute, I will read it. You can explain it.
Okay. And, of course, the
Actually, I can read it right now, Bernie.
Yeah.
It's the very first sentence of Article 1, Section 8. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States.
No, but there it is, Joe. It's not more complicated than that. And I think until very recently, everybody understood that, of course, the United States Congress has the right to protect the best interest of the United States of America. And that means, obviously, defending our country on one hand, but second of all, doing the best that we can for our people. And what does that mean? It means retirement security, i.e. Social Security. It means making sure that people do not die or suffer needlessly because they don't have health care. And that means Medicare and Medicaid. But there are some people who have bought into the line of the Koch brothers and other billionaires that what America really should be about is giving huge tax breaks to the very wealthiest people who are already phenomenally rich, and cutting back on programs that help working families and the middle class. The vast majority of the American people, in poll after poll, do not agree with this. You can ask people whether they think it makes sense to cut back or eliminate Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid overwhelmingly, regardless of their political perspective. They say no. But you have a small number of people who have incredible amounts of money, and they're able to use that money in the political process supporting candidates who are advocating what is, in fact, a fringe position. So to answer Joe's view, yeah, I happen to believe that in a democratic, civilized society, government certainly has the right and the duty to do everything it can to protect the middle class and working families of this country. That means having a strong and viable Social Security system that lasts for at least the next 75 years, paying out all benefits owed to eligible Americans and making sure that Americans have the health care they need. I myself would go further than Medicare and Medicaid. I want to see a Medicare for All single-payer system, which guarantees health care to all people in this country as a right.
And by the way, the Supreme Court has been agreeing with you since 1936. Jeff in New Haven, Connecticut, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator. I'm thrilled to be on with you. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Thank you.
You know, I listen week after week, and I just find myself agreeing with just everything that you say, and it's such a measured response to critics and no matter what the topic is that you speak on. I think I would really love to see you face off in a presidential debate in 2016 with whatever the Republicans could throw up, or even against Democrats in primaries. I would love to see this. What do you think about that? Do you think it's a viable proposition? And just what do you think?
Well, Chuck, thank you very much for your kind words. I really appreciate that. No, I'm not guy. I am extraordinarily happy and proud to be representing the state of Vermont in the United States Senate. You know, Chuck, I am the longest serving independent in American congressional history, and I'm very proud that the people of Vermont have allowed me to serve them in the House and now in the Senate. I'm running for re-election, hope to get re-elected. So my plans are to stay in the Senate and do my best for Vermont and for working families around the country. But thank you very much for those kind words.
Norm in Fort Myers, Florida. Norm, we just have a minute before the break. Real quick question, or?
Maybe not. Thank you both for all you do, both of you. But in regards to the trade agreements that were long stalled and recently passed with Korea, Colombia, and Panama, The U.S. agricultural groups seem to be very pleased. I'd like to know who wins and who loses on both sides of that deal.
Well, Norm, that's a great question. And there are always winners and losers. And sometimes it is agriculture that is, or certain sectors of agriculture that are winners. I, in general, believe, having voted against virtually all of the trade agreements that have come down the pike since NAFTA, think that the American worker is a significant loser in these unfettered free trade agreements. And the reason is pretty obvious. I guess let's pick that up, Tom.
We will do that. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman program. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. You can get the Bernie buzz.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You can also, at Bernie's website, Sanders.Senate.gov, you can sign his constitutional amendment to roll back Citizens United. This is important stuff.
Oh, everyone believes.
Welcome back to Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. Bernie, you were just wrapping up or addressing a question about trade a few minutes ago.
Norm from Florida asked a question, which was a good question. Basically, he wanted to know, hey, in trade agreements, who are the winners and who are the losers? And in general, in my view, and others may well disagree, I would say the average American manufacturing worker is the loser in unfettered free trade agreements. And you don't have to be a PhD in economics to figure it out. If you are a large multinational corporation, a General Electric or anybody else, you can shut down plants in the United States of America, move to China and other low-wage countries, pay people a fraction of the wages that you used to pay in the United States, and then bring your product back into the United States. Tom, in the last 10 years, almost 60,000 factories in America have been shut down, not all of them due to trade. Automation has also played an important role, but many of them have. What the other reality that is going on today is that even within manufacturing, we're seeing wages for manufacturing workers going down significantly compared to where they used to be. And all of that has to do with American workers being forced to compete against people in other countries who are paid pennies an hour. So I would say to Norm that I think the manufacturing workers of America have been the major losers in these unfettered free trade agreements.
Yeah. Mark, in Minneapolis, listening on KFTP on Minneapolis Progressive Talk. You're on the air, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. This is Mark. And it's an honor to talk to you, Senator Sanders and Tom. I've got kind of a combination suggestion and question relative to the Postal Service. I mean, they've already put aside all the money they'll ever need to fund their programs. Why not just stop trying to comply with that law and wait until either your legislation succeeds or, Democrats get back to Congress and you can take it off the books? I mean, it wouldn't harm anybody.
Well, Mark, the danger is, and the reason I have been working so hard postal reform legislation, is this is a response to a concept that the Postmaster General came out with about 9 or 10 months ago. And his initial proposal was to shut down some 3,700 rural post offices and half the processing plants in the country. So if the Congress does nothing, it doesn't act at all, then the Postmaster General is off and running. Now, what I will say in deference to the Postmaster General, he has moderated his views in the last couple of months, and I don't think that is what he is now thinking about. But we do need strong legislation to address this problem of the $5.5 billion going from the Postal Service into future retiree health benefits, which, in my view, is no longer needed, and I think in a significant way is being addressed by this legislation.
Reginald in Houston, Texas. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Thank you all for taking me. You know, we had Alec here. You know, we have companies that are divesting from Alec. You know, corporations like the Gates, McDonald's, and Target, and so forth and so on. With these divestments here, I think that's a positive thing, and maybe we can take those divestments to open up community banks, do a little social justice. That's the power of the people. And also, you got the Stand Your Ground law. You guys talking about repealing it from the federal law, federal side. And Eric Holder tried to do something with the Fast and Furious, the NRA. Didn't get anywhere. They flipped that on him. Can you guys enforce that with him from Eric Holder's side to get this Stand Your Ground rule in place and the Brady rules in place to try to handle that from that level? Can you answer both of those questions, please?
Well, let's say about the Stand Your Ground legislation. That legislation, you know, is passed by many, many states around the country. It worries me very much. It just gives a green light to people to be trigger happy. If somebody insults them, somebody looks at them the wrong way, that is not what self-defense is about. Self-defense is a legitimate legal tradition in America. You have the right to defend yourself, but I worry very much about these stand your grounds, and I hope that state by state, we will begin rethinking that legislation. Reginald talked about the power of people. Not quite sure exactly where he was going, but I'll tell you something that we're doing in Vermont, happening around the rest of the country as well in terms of economics. And it's something that I wish we could be more aggressive with at the federal government level, but there's obviously opposition, and that is worker control, worker ownership of businesses. In Vermont now, we have a number of businesses, many of them are doing quite well, where workers themselves have bought out previous owners. They are managing the company, and it is an example of when people come together, they can, in fact, run profitable, productive companies. Morale is much higher. Absenteeism is much lower than with other companies. I hope, you know, we haven't succeeded yet at the federal level because of strong opposition, but I would hope that we can make resources available to workers around the country who are interested in buying out their employers. And you have a lot of employers out there. Many of them started a business, are getting old. They would like the opportunity, if possible, to leave their businesses to their employees. And we want to create a way to make that happen.
Yeah, and that's only possible in some states. So you're talking about providing a federal infrastructure for that, or
right.
superstructure, legal yep. structure. Bernie, we have just a minute to wrap the show up. We've got a dozen people on hold to talk to you, but it wouldn't be time enough. Your thoughts for the week?
Well, my thoughts for the week is next week in the Senate, at least, it's going to be a busy week. Postal reform is coming up. What we are fighting there is to see that some 200,000 jobs in the middle of a recession are not lost at the Postal Service, that we retain rural post offices all over America, and rapid mail delivery standards. So I hope people pay attention to that issue. I hope they call up their members of the Senate and urge them to support the strongest possible legislation. We also have got to continue the struggle to overturn Citizens United, one of the worst decisions ever rendered by a United States Supreme Court. Everybody should be concerned about the growing influence of big money in the political process.
And I would add, you still have on your website at sanders.senate.gov that
we
constitutional
sure
amendment. People can get over there and sign up for it. So, you know, say, yes, I support Bernie in trying to overturn this at sanders.senate.gov. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Always a pleasure. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Anything Goes Friday. There's a lot in the news that I want to get to as we go through the day. I think it's sufficiently important that it's worth mentioning. First of all, today is 420. Most significantly, you know, which is like code for let's smoke dope. But most importantly, it's the first 420 in the history of the United States when a majority of Americans think that marijuana should be decriminalized and treated as either a medicine or as a medicine and a recreational drug like alcohol is. And or just altogether decriminalized. It's also Adolf Hitler's birthday, but you know that's got some folks real excited. Not so much here. And it is the anniversary of 2 years from today, the BP oil spill. Boy, what a conflation. Secret Service sex scandal. This is getting interesting. One of the agents who has offered to take a lie detector test says he didn't realize he was taking a prostitute back to his room, which raises the question, who hired and paid these women? Or was he just that good looking? I don't know. And in fact, she never asked for money. And so it's like, this is getting kind of strange. George Zimmerman was let out on bond today. He made a statement from the defendant's chair sitting next to the judge, in which he said that he was sorry for the loss of Trayvon Martin. He didn't realize that he was as young as he was, Trayvon, and interestingly, he said, I didn't know if he was armed or not, which raises in my mind, I'm not a criminal defense lawyer or a prosecutor, but if somebody, even using a defense of a stand your ground law, has the stand your ground shoot first laws, have they lowered the bar so far that you can kill somebody, you can use deadly force against a person when you don't know if they're armed or not? If they're capable of using deadly force against you. It's very, very strange. Very interesting. South Sudan has withdrawn their soldiers from the disputed oil fields in the northern part of South Sudan. Bashir in North Sudan, or Sudan, says that doesn't matter. He's still going to have a war. We'll see how that plays out. And Hillary Clinton is pushing for an arms embargo against Syria. The troops are shelling homes today. Bad news coming out of Syria. And a West Virginia Senate candidate equates this John Reese. He's running for the U.S. Senate as a Republican in West Virginia. And he's very upset about a smoking ban in Monongalia County, West Virginia. I'm sure I'm mismangling that. Monongalia. Oh, say it again. Monongahela. Oh, I've heard that. Yeah, in West Virginia. Anyhow, he's very upset, and he said that this is the equivalent of the ban. He's equating that with Hitler forcing Jews to wear the Star of David. Yes, he went there. Pretty amazing. So, anyway, that's everything on, well, not everything, but that's the beginning of, oh, the biggest thing on my list. And I ranted about this yesterday. I want to make it very clear. I started out playing with this like it was a joke. But I don't think this is a joke. I'm actually starting to think that this might be an actual serious reality, and we all need to be talking about it. And that is that Karl Rove has raised $76 million that he will not tell us where it came from. 62% of the $123 million that his super PAC Crossroads has raised. $76 million. We have no idea where it came from. And I'm just putting two and two together in my head. The Reagan administration was Iran's best friend. Okay, the Carter administration hated Iran. Jimmy Carter had an embargo on Iran. Iran, you know, took the hostages. Jimmy Carter almost went to war with Iran. They didn't like Democrat Carter. But they cut a deal with the Republican Reagan, known as the Iran-Contra scandal. And Reagan sold them weapons illegally. Gave them weapons, sold them weapons, you know. So Reagan helped out Iran tremendously. Then the next Republican to come along, well, then you know, after Reagan and Bush, you had a Democratic administration, Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton was, again, hostile to the Iranians, put a strong embargo on them. But in 1999, a company by the name of Halliburton was illegally, or some would say illegally, Halliburton claims it was not because they laundered it through a front company someplace in Europe, but Halliburton was selling things to Iran that could have been used to produce nuclear weapons. And that decision was apparently made by Dick Cheney when he was CEO of Halliburton, and he became the vice president in 2000. And so we got another Republican administration, and what did they do? So the question is always, what are the Republicans going to do for Iran? Right, in the Reagan administration, they sold them weapons. During the Clinton administration, Republican vice presidential nominee, candidate, soon-to-be vice president Dick Cheney, former congressman, Republican congressman, former head of, you know, Jerry Ford's chief of staff, Dick Cheney was selling things to the Iranians. And then Iran's number one enemy in the world was who? Just think about this for a minute. Who fought a war with Iran for about a decade? Over a million men died in that war. It cost billions of dollars. Who fought that war? Saddam Hussein. The biggest enemy in the world of Iran was Saddam Hussein. In 2003, George W. Bush invaded Iraq, and in 2006, December of 2006, he hung, in fact, he ripped the head off the top of the body of Saddam Hussein, and it rolled around on the floor. The Iranians were ecstatic. In fact, the next year, they set up the Bank of Iran in Baghdad. So the Iranians have to be, and then Obama came into office, and boom, down came the wall, and the Iranians are back in poor favor, shall we say. And they're being embargoed, and, you know, they're getting all this pressure, and Obama even was successful in getting the Chinese and the Russians to participate in pressuring Iran. So Iran is like, you know, they need another Republican. So I would wager, and I'm not a betting man, but I would wager that some of those millions or tens of millions of dollars that have gone to Karl Rove's GPS PAC, which are being used and have been used and will be used to take out Democratic politicians and to try to take down President Obama politically and get Republicans elected, that some of that money either came directly from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, laundered, of course, through an American holding company, something like that. You know, some one level of maybe a couple of levels of invisibility. Or came from companies like, you know, like Halliburton was when Dick Cheney was the CEO of it, that are making millions or billions of dollars doing business illegally with Iran, and they want to get back to it. And so they want another Republican presidency. Because the Republicans over the last 30 years have been Iran's best friend, and the Democrats have been Iran's enemy. And Karl Rove has been right in the middle of all of this stuff, and here he is raising $123 million, $76 million of it. We have no idea where it came from. We do know it came from fewer than 100 people. That one particular donor gave him $10 million the year before last and $10 million last year. We have no idea who it was. I think it was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. One way or another, either as a direct contribution or through the back door. And, of course, the Supreme Court made all this possible. Aren't they wonderful? 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And now, my rant is done, we will get back to Anything Goes Friday. Your calls.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. One of the we had a caller on the line for a while who dropped off, but I just wanted to answer the question who had asked why, you know, who had pointed out the Senator Sanders amendment, constitutional amendment, it specifies for-profit corporations as not having human rights, but doesn't specify not-for-profit corporations. And somebody called and was going to ask why. Somebody called a couple of weeks ago and asked Bernie about that. And he basically said, you know, it's an imperfect first draft, and the next time around we'll, you know, next congressional session or next year, it'll be different. So they're, you know, step by step. But it's still a great beginning point and therefore worthy of endorsement. In my opinion and in his opinion, because, you know, I mean, the state of Vermont, actually, what they passed through their legislature yesterday went farther than Bernie's amendment. And that's why I think, that's why I know, and Bernie has said so, that when he reintroduces the amendment, that it'll be even stronger. It'll be more emphatic and more broad and sweeping. Richard in Manassas, Virginia. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's an absolute pleasure on this end, anyway.
Well, thank you for calling. Nice to hear from you. What's up?
Well, my question to Bernie was, has anybody taken a look at the Citizens Bailout Program? It seems to be a lot of opportunities.
Are you talking about the program that the president proposed, that where Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac would write down the principal on home mortgages to the point of the value of the house so that homeowners can refinance their homes easily and get out from underneath these exploding mortgages?
No, I was not.
What are you talking about then?
Well, I'm the founder of Citizens Bailout Program.
I see. Okay.
And it's a program. I have a little economics background. It's mm-hmm. a program that I took from about 10 different programs, the best of, and tried to make as many opportunities for citizens.
Okay. Well, I wish you the best with it, Richard, and people now know where they can find it. And good luck. Good luck. Claire in Minneapolis. Hey, Claire, thanks for listening to AM 950. What's up?
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to ask you what citizens can possibly do locally. I mean, democracy is local. But we have a Vikings team that wants the citizens to pay for their stadium.
Sure.
And this is very, very controversial. And, in fact, our legislature voted it down. I was absolutely thrilled. I never thought they would. So the NFL has now flown in here, and they're really putting the pressure on the NFL, and everybody's really going after this. We have a law here that in 1997 that requires voter approval of these kinds of subsidies, and what they're trying to do is get rid of the law. What can you do? I mean, I'm going to be on the phone all next week, but what can you do about something like this?
What all of us can do, and particularly you were absolutely right saying democracy really begins at the local level, and the thing that's corrupting it, of course, is things like Karl Rove getting $123 million, maybe some of it from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, but the point is that you have a state representative, you have a state senator, you have a governor, you have a member of the House of Representatives, U.S. House of Representatives, and you have two senators. That's what, six? Did I just add up? That you can call. You've got a mayor that you can call. You've got a city council representative that you can call. You're in Minneapolis, right? Yeah, in Minneapolis. So you've got a city councilor. These are all starting points. These are pressure points. Then you can also you have a newspaper that you can write letters to the editor to. There are other talk shows on the air in Minneapolis that you can call into as well as this one. And not just on this station, although you should just listen to the station all day long, but you can call into the other ones and just make your point. Just everything you can think of. This is an all hands on deck time in American history, not just, the issue of, the NFL and what, they're trying to get you guys to basically provide them with corporate welfare, but just the whole concept of pushing back against corporate power and pushing and taking back our democracy. And then there are local citizens' movements, and there are national citizens' movements that you can participate in. Progressive Democrats of America, do they have a local chapter? If not, you could start one. PDAmerica.org is the website for, to find that out. If you want to do a training, if you want to learn how to be a citizen activist, a Democracy for America, the organization that Howard Dean started, that Jim Dean, his brother, now runs, Democracy for America, FORAmerica.com is their website. They will come to your community. They do trainings. Again, you can start a local branch of that organization. MoveOn.org is doing good work. The 99 Spring is doing good work. You've got the Occupy movement in Minneapolis. Go down and show up at the local Occupy movement. Talk to everybody you know. I mean, you add all that stuff up, and it becomes a lot, and it can produce a lot of change. Making sense, Claire?
Yeah, it does. Let me ask you one thing.
Oh, and one last thing. Show up for your local Democratic Party meetings and your local Republican Party meetings. And if there's an active local Green Party or Libertarian Party, show up for those meetings, too. Pardon my interrupting you.
No. I'm watching Michigan, and I believe that this looks like the canary in the coal mine for those states.
You're watching democracy die in Michigan right now.
I know, it's terrifying. Well, I thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire, for the call, and I appreciate it. We have just a few seconds here before we have to take our break. Representative Virginia Fox, remember yesterday we reported on this, we played the clip, how she has very little respect for students who are $80,000 to $200,000 in debt. Turns out that it could be that she has very little respect for students who are in debt for their complaining, for their whining. In other words, she has very little sympathy for them. Little tolerance, actually, was the phrase she used, little tolerance. Could be because she's getting big bucks from the corporations that are funding her that run these for-profit schools. $50,000 so far she's raked in from the for-profit college industry. Gee, what a surprise. And she thinks it's just fine, students are in debt.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with your calls on Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. Welcome back to Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. And, I'm hearing myself in my ear there. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And your calls on pretty much any topic. Frank in Seattle listening to Talk 1090. Hey, Frank, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know what? I've been kind of, really following this whole Trayvon Martin case. And what I'm really questioning about is this whole, you know, stand your ground law makes no sense. It makes sense if someone comes onto your property or into your home that you should be able to stand your ground. But I think stalking somebody in your car and carrying a gun and then approaching them, I think that people are forgetting that Trayvon Martin probably had a little bit of a stand your ground in his own favor because he wasn't in a place where he shouldn't have been. And for some reason, they keep dismissing the fact that he was being stalked, you know, by someone who was probably a little loony.
Yeah. Yeah, it's we still don't know and won't know until there's a trial all the details. But what has happened? But your point is well taken. And what has happened with these stand your ground, shoot first laws is they have changed the threshold of what you have to do outside of your own home, what you have to do to be able to legally kill another person. And it used to be that you had to be pretty sure that you were about to be killed. Now you can just be seriously PO'd. Basically, is what it comes down to. Natalie in Auburn, Alabama. Hey, Natalie, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I was concerned because there seems to be a problem between distinguishing between white-collar criminals and blue-collar criminals.
Yes. We have two different criminal justice systems in the United States. Blue-collar criminals, you know, working people, poor people, particularly people of color, have a very harsh and brutal criminal justice system. White-collar criminals, people who devastate people's lives, you know, cause suicides and home, you know, break up families, and they get basically off. Or if they have to go to jail, it's a country club.
Yeah, but people who are considered successful sociopaths or whatever, you know, they get off scot-free.
Yeah, the relatively not so bright or incompetent sociopaths who just, you know, kill people or, you know, rob people.
Unorganized versus organized criminals.
Right, right. But the very, very competent, very smart sociopaths who have figured out the game and got well-educated and were members of the Lucky Sperm Club, were born into wealthy families to begin with so they could go to the right schools, they end up as the heads of some of the largest corporations or the most political powerful people in the country. And
how do you think they got there?
Well, by using their sociopathy, actually. I mean, you know, you could argue, you have to ask yourself, why does, you know, if being a sociopath is genetic, or if there's a component to it, you know, if this is something that shows up in the human genome, why does it persist from generation to generation? Well, it may be that it's adaptive, that it, you know, people like Donald Trump, you know, seven wives now, he's had the opportunity to spread his DNA far and wide, right?
More monetarily.
Yeah, well, there's that too.
More a personality disorder, because there are a lot of our politicians who have what you could say would be personality disorders.
Yes.
You know, there are people who are very organized who can have personality disorders.
Right. Yeah.
People who are deceitful in business. You look it up in the book, you know, they say a repeated liar, people who have no empathy for other people who lose money.
Yes, these are sociopaths. No, Natalie, you're absolutely right. Thank you for watching Free Speech TV, and thanks for your call. Cedric in Miami. Hey, Cedric, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I enjoy your program very much. I wanted to make a comment about the Stand Your Ground law. I live in Florida, and that law is effective here. And that law came out of the self-defense that you were allowed to do if you could prove that you retreated before you responded to deadly force with deadly force. And living in a society, in an environment like South Florida, it's rather dangerous. And the law became necessary because people would catch you at a red light, stick a gun in your face, and take your car. And they would catch you at a ATM, stick a gun in your face, and make you take money out of the ATM.
Right.
So
Stand Your Ground law, if somebody sticks a gun in your face, you're justified in killing them.
Well, you don't need
a Stand Your Ground law to do that. First of all, the examples you're using are not the kinds of things that would happen in the real world. Because if somebody sticks a gun in your face, odds are, no matter where your gun is, you're not going to get it out in time to shoot them, right?
Well, the law said that you had to have it in your glove compartment and had to be locked. So even if you had a chance to get to your gun, you had to open your glove compartment and get it out. That's what's proof of you retreating. Or you had to retreat away from the challenge and then you could respond with deadly force if you were being threatened with deadly force.
Yeah.
Someone walks up to you, piss you off, you still don't have the license to shoot them with this stand your ground law, because you have to respond to deadly force with deadly force under this stand your ground.
No, under the stand your ground law, Cedric, you have to feel threatened. We have had this debate twice now, and it gone through the actual language of the law. It is not as you're representing it. William in North Bend, Oregon. Hey, William, what's up? Listening to KBBR.
Yeah. Well, good afternoon, Tom. I'm a first-time telephone caller, and I am registered to vote here in both the primary as well as general elections, and I also correspond, which I am imploring all listeners to write civilly, dear sirs, madams, council, chairpersons of all committees in both houses of Congress, their legislators, their county commissioners, county boards of supervisors, county councils, mayors, et cetera, all honorables, civilly. The purpose of
you've expanded my list from the earlier caller. Well done.
Well, yeah, and it is absolutely essential. Voting is, one does not have to be a lobbyist.
Yeah.
And we have the 14th Amendment, 13th, 14th, and 15th, and we're open for sensible, we're well overdue, in honoring labor, entering that into the Constitution, and taking the word ordained and converting that into liberated persons and people. But the purpose of my telephone call, this concerns a foreign nation of Iran. In our Constitution articles, we have treaties, and we were to do no harm. We have the Geneva Conventions, Helsinki Accords, Warsaw Pact. We have the Nuremberg.
We're not a signatory to the Warsaw Pact, but we are a signatory to the UN, the various treaties that created the UN.
Conventions on the Geneva Conventions.
Sure.
But the purpose of my telephone call, this does concern Iran, and there's been a lot of disinformation and misinformation. Now, rather than put you on the line, Tom, what I'd like to do is to ask you, because this is your program, it's not mine, I'm not going to come in and take it over. I've heard a lot of that, but I'd like to ask you and implore your audience to look at what is really occurring with the Sinai treaties that we have, and that includes Iran. What is occurring is a diversion. It is the financial houses, the banksters, what have you, that are playing off, for instance, Iraq, Israel, Iran against one another. And presently, I'd like to ask you to research through a Department of State, Warren Christopher, when he was Secretary of State, honorables, of course, Hillary Rodham Clinton, and then records then with
William. Thank you for your call. The point that you're saying that we're being deceived about Iran, and let me add to that, just for the record, and I think that this is so important because most Americans don't realize this. All 18 of the United States' intelligence agencies, the CIA, the NSA, the various military defense agencies, the FBI, all 18 of them, I don't even know the names of all of them. And probably some of them are secret names, but all 18 U.S. agencies and the State Department have said Iran does not have and is not in the process of actively developing nuclear weapons. They are perhaps positioning themselves to have nuclear power and they are developing nuclear power, and they could use that conceivably to put themselves in that position, but they are not in that position right now. And there has been a mind-boggling amount of disinformation about that for some time on radio and television. Saul in Miami. Hey, Saul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you? I'm a first-time caller.
Thank you.
Tom, I'm a registered Republican, mm-hmm. but I have not voted Republican for several administrations now. Now, I have a question which I share here with my colleagues and argue many times. I remember during the 2008 presidential election, right after President Obama was elected, I remember vividly President Bush appear before the American public in a broadcast television conference addressing the nation, in which he was pitching an urgency to introduce a stimulus package to stimulate the United States economy.
Right.
And then after that, President Obama took office, and supposedly he volleyed real hard to push the stimulus package. And even, if I remember accurately, I remember that even Alan Greenspan and some other economists were saying that the stimulus package needed to be a lot more.
Yes, it needed to be $2.5 trillion, and what Obama got was $800 billion, and about a third of that was tax cuts, which don't stimulate the economy. So your recollection is correct, Saul, and it's this is purely a partisan thing. The Republicans didn't want the economy to rebound.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And this is why, for example, a transportation bill which would put people back to work and would stimulate the economy can pass with 74 votes out of the Senate with a whole bunch of Republican votes, and they still stop it dead in the House. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. On the line with us. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Well, at least three more Secret Service officers implicated in our prostitution scandal in Colombia are expected to lose their jobs today.
Mm-hmm. I thought I got your news report this morning. In fact, it was like 6:25 in the morning you put this thing out. I'm really impressed. In any case,
yeah.
I got your news report this morning, and in it you pointed out that at least one of these guys who is willing to take a lie detector test says he didn't realize that it was a hooker that he was with. Was somebody else buying women for them, or is this how it's done in Colombia? You just don't ask until the next morning, what happened?
Well, it seems.
Or was this guy just really good looking and he was used to women throwing themselves at him?
Well, I don't know, but it gets a bit murky because one of the women says, "I'm not a prostitute. I was there with my friend who's a prostitute, and I did spend the night in a room with one of the guys. He was very timid," her word, "and we shortly after we went into the room, we both fell asleep with our clothes on. He never even kissed me." Now, I have to tell you, Tom, women do things as stupid as this.
Yeah, I suppose men do, too. But
they do things like this. And she also said that the next morning when the dispute about the money broke out, some of the other agents were astonished that a guy had a woman in his room, and they were pretty outraged about it. And this report is borne out by the taxi driver, a taxi driver who drove them home, and senior American officials.
Right. So how does this...
There's more than one thing going on here.
You know, yeah, obviously this is a complex situation and a salacious one. How does it become political, though? I don't understand why Fox News is all over this and everybody else is like, in fact, I haven't talked about it that much. You know, I mentioned your story and that's it. To me, it doesn't seem like, big news. But Fox and all the Republicans and all the right-wing talk show hosts think it's huge news. You know, how does this get political?
Because Senator Jeff Sessions and Sarah Palin get in on the act and say the allegations reflect poor management of the government under Obama, Palin describing the affair as a government symptom of government run amok. It's like, who's minding the store around here, Palin said. Jay Carney said today it was preposterous to politicize the issue.
Yeah, I agree. It is preposterous. But I guess I shouldn't be surprised that Sarah Palin would try to do so.
Or Jeff Sessions, quite frankly. I mean, Jay Carney excoriated the two, frankly, in the briefing today.
Yeah. So what else is going on? What's the real news in the world?
Well, there is more, and there will be some more phone news, but there is actually real news. Very interesting today. A judge today... Judge Gregory Weeks of Cumberland County Superior Court in North Carolina, concluding that racial bias played a significant factor in the sentencing of a man to death 18 years ago, ordered that the man's sentence be reduced to life in prisons without parole. This is the first such decision under North Carolina's controversial Racial Justice Act.
Which says basically that if you were convicted by a jury, and that jury was selected by the prosecutor on the basis of race, which would largely be, I would think, all white juries convicting African Americans,
right.
But it could be the other way around, that isn't a jury of your peers. That isn't the way that jurisprudence is supposed to work, and therefore your conviction is not legitimate.
Exactly. The judge said race was a materially, practically, and statistically significant factor in the decision to exercise peremptory challenges during jury selection by prosecutors at the time of the trial. And in fact, this is landmark rulings expected to be the first of many under this law, because defendants and death row inmates are allowed to present evidence, including statistical patterns. And this is a result of a study by Michigan State University researchers showing that prosecutors use peremptory challenges to remove blacks from juries more than twice as often as they use challenges against whites. And the study, Judge Weeks found it valid and reliable, and found the disparity not only existed statewide, but to an even greater degree in Cumberland County, where this particular guy was. Now, the prosecutors are going to appeal it, fiercely opposed the law, and said, no, the race is not the motive. Actually said, they don't have evidence of purposeful discrimination. They don't have some secret society of prosecutors maniacally plotting to remove people from juries. They don't have any of that because there is no such evidence. It doesn't exist. They have numbers.
Numbers meaning?
They have numbers.
Oh, it's two to one. It's a statistical analysis.
Right. In other words, they've got evidence.
Right.
And he doesn't like the fact that they have evidence.
Right, apparently. Okay.
Apparently not. WikiLeaks. High-profile U.S. supporters of WikiLeaks are planning to establish a foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Daniel Ellsberg is heading this thing up, isn't he?
That's right. Daniel Ellsberg, also John Perry Barlow, former lyricist for the Grateful Dead and co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Wow. And yeah. And this is to get around the embargo that was placed on WikiLeaks by a bunch of for-profit corporations, PayPal, the banks,
Visa, exactly.
They won't process funds for WikiLeaks, which seems to me, you know, I'm all in favor of private parties being able to contract with each other, you know, on their own terms, but shouldn't there be a law that says that if somebody's not committing a crime and they're trying to engage in commerce, that and you're the gatekeeper for commerce, that you have to participate, you know, the banks have to participate?
You would think so, but the banks sort of said, well, we kind of think there's no political involvement, but they sort of said, well, MasterCard rules prohibit customers from directly or indirectly engaging in or facilitating any action that is illegal.
So their concern was that the WikiLeaks action was illegal.
Yeah, but they're apparently not concerned about any other company that might be illegal.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they haven't blocked anybody else that I'm aware of.
Right, or they seem to love the porn sites, for example.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Melanie Rousseau is with us. She is the National Press Secretary for the DNC, dnc.org, the website, The Secret Mitt Romney. Melanie, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
The Secret Mitt Romney? What have I missed here?
The Secret Mitt Romney. Are we talking about the video we put out?
Yes.
Well, Mitt Romney is keeping a lot of things secret, as you know. He won't release his tax returns. He gave the McCain campaign 23 years worth of tax returns. So far, he's only given one. He filed an extension for his 2011 returns. As best we know, we may see them 3 weeks before the election. He won't release his bundlers for his campaign. There are a lot of things Mitt Romney doesn't talk about, and we're just wondering what he has to hide.
That's very interesting. I wonder if he's being funded by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
We won't know. Following the law, which is what he'll say. Mm-hmm. He is releasing what the FEC requires. But as you know, President Obama goes above that because he is believes that transparency is important. And so today the president's campaign released a list of all of the president's bundlers, and we've been asking for quite some time for Mitt Romney to do the same. It's something that John McCain did and George W. Bush did. There's no reason why that we can see why Mitt Romney can't do the same.
Yeah, very interesting. He recently addressed an RNC meeting of state party chairs in Phoenix. Anything of consequence happen out of that?
Well, John McCain introduced him, and as you know, they've not always been the best of friends, and they are on opposite ends of issues. I think one important thing is this meeting was held in Arizona, where, as you know, it is the site of one of the most extreme immigration laws in the country. Many pieces of it have been stopped by court systems.
Right.
And Mitt Romney has called the Arizona law a model for the nation.
Oh my.
He's supported by and has counted on Kris Kobach as one of his advisors to his campaign. Kris Kobach is the Secretary of State for Kansas, who helped draft the Arizona law and the really extreme Alabama law, immigration law. The Arizona governor, Jan Brewer, is an endorser. Russell Pierce is also an author of the Arizona law and supports Mitt Romney. So he is in a state where he is aligned with the faces of anti-immigration and in the home base of this anti-immigration movement and has a very extreme position on this.
Fascinating. So much for the Hispanic vote, but maybe not. I thought that when he basically had this nomination in the bag, which I believe he's had from the beginning, but nonetheless, that he would, quote, tack to the middle. But apparently he's still in bed with the hard right-wingers and pushing these hard right-wing views. He was a severely conservative governor, and he said he would veto the DREAM Act.
Yes, he did.
I just find it all quite extraordinary. You want to say something?
We expect him to still try to etch a sketch his way away from some of these positions and try to rewrite history, but he can. It's all on camera.
Yeah.
It's all in writing. And he would be the most extreme anti-immigration presidential nominee in modern history.
Interesting. So we're still pre-etch a sketch.
I think this week he Kris Kobach was demoted by his campaign from advisor to supporter.
Is the beginning of the Etch-a-Sketch.
I think this is probably the beginning of the Etch-a-Sketch. He's just one shake in so far.
Yeah,
so.
The first shake. Melanie, thanks so much for being with us.
So much for having me.
I appreciate it and sharing your perspective. And, we have invited the Republican National Committee to drop by, too. We'll see what happens with that. Mark Taylor Canfield with Occupy Seattle. Hey, Mark, what's on the line? Or what's up? You're on the air.
Well, I got a couple quick updates and then a very interesting story about a possible infiltration of the Democratic Party by Occupy Wall Street activists. Here in Seattle, there have been dozens of rallies and protests, and there will be more happening between now and May Day, including a protest happening right now at the home of Mayor Mike McGinn demanding an end to the epidemic of homelessness in our area. And then another major demonstration that the Gates Foundation is planning on April 25th as part of the National Day of Protest Against $1 trillion in Student Debt. They're calling it 1T Day. We're still fighting a battle over free speech on local college campuses, but we're waiting on a vote from the Board of Trustees on the 17th. Mm-hmm. And Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair were here, so we got to hear a scathing critique of the Obama administration from the editors of Counterpunch. But what has surprised me, Tom, is the number of occupiers like myself who have traditionally considered themselves Democrats who attended the party caucuses in Washington and in other states, got themselves elected precinct chair people, got themselves elected, so in some cases, uncommitted delegates, and were able to introduce resolutions which specifically endorse the Occupy Wall Street and the objectives of the Occupy Wall Street, including stopping the home foreclosures, stopping the bailouts of the major corporations, protecting our civil liberties and into the foreign military intervention and the outsourcing of jobs. And I myself was able to do that and was able to get a resolution introduced to the Washington State Democrats It's just very, very specific and very, very close to the city council resolution that was passed here in Seattle, which endorses the Occupy Wall Street movement and calls upon the National Democratic Party to include these objectives in their national party platform.
That's
I'm not holding my breath, Tom, because I know that, you know, the Democratic Party has got a lot of corporate influence controlling it these days, but these are traditionally democratic values. I mean, this is what the Democratic Party used to be about. I'm not sure if it is anymore, but I'm willing to give it a shot, give it a try, and present this through a democratic process and see what the Democratic Party decides to do with it.
Well, and change sometimes takes time, and usually it takes time. And but that doesn't mean you don't do it. You don't get out there and do it. So, Mark, good on you. Mark Taylor Canfield with Occupy Seattle. Thank you, Mark. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Noah, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I agree with you 100% that rolling back the Reagan tax cuts and re-regulating the banks would be a great idea. The problem I see with that is basically what economist Richard Wolff brought up in one of his speeches, and I'm sure he says it all the time on his radio show, but I think he has a radio show.
He does.
Wouldn't the boards of directors of all the large corporations just work to undo those things and do it at even less time than they did in the last 40 years since they've gotten so good at it? Don't we need to change the organization of these companies to be more democratic?
Yeah, small d democratic. What Richard Wolff has proposed, and many other economists, is that there's only a limited number of states. I think it's 20, 25 states in the United States that explicitly have laws that allow what are called B corporations, corporations that are created for the benefit of their employees and their community, where the employees actually own the corporation or run the corporation, and or both. And we need to, and this is something Bernie was talking about, is, you know, take this national. Provide a national framework for it. Although corporations are created typically at the state level by the state attorney general's office, or the secretary of state's office in each state, and so you do need state laws that allow for this. And so there's an education process here. We need to get people informed about the fact that there are states in the United States where you can't create a co-op corporation, a genuine cooperative, a worker-owned cooperative. You might be able to create a membership cooperative, like the, you know, that local health food store. But not a worker-owned cooperative where the employees are the owners rather than the customers are the owners. And, you know, that's an important step. But even more important is changing the Supreme Court doctrines that were created out of whole cloth by the Supreme Court that say, number one, that money is not property, it's speech. And number two, that corporations are not legal fictions, they are persons with rights under the Constitution. We need to change both of those, and that is going to take either a significant change in the makeup of the Supreme Court or a constitutional amendment. And we should be working to try and accomplish both. Noah, thanks for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Anything Goes Friday. And by the way, the AFL-CIO just came out with this new executive pay watch report. The average income, and this is before all the stock options and everything kick in, this is just the paycheck of the Fortune 500 CEOs, $12 million a year last year, 2011. That's $1 million a month. That's $250,000 a week. Now, a brain surgeon might make $250,000 or $500,000 or even $1 million in the course of a year, but a CEO, somebody who's selling Twinkies, is making a $250,000 a week. There's something fundamentally wrong with this. And now the Romney rich and the you know, multimillionaire Paul Ryan and the Republicans in the House, they want to add a $3 trillion tax cut for the Romney rich. It's just incredible. Paul in Denison, Texas. Hey, Paul, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to say thanks for being the most effective communicator and wise broadcaster. And I know that's why the major media is just absolutely scared to death of you. It's just because you are such an intelligent.
Well, thank you for your kind words, Paul. I appreciate it. I'm not sure that anybody's scared to death of me. But Dan in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? I have a couple of questions regarding the post office. Bernie had mentioned in the first hour that he said he was kind of saying that he knew where the Postmaster General stands on all the stuff that's going on. But frankly, I don't know where the Postmaster General stands, to be honest with you. I'm listening on Sirius. I listen to the Sirius Left channel most of my day, in between you and Ed, Stephanie, and so on. Like, I've never heard the Postmaster General on with anybody, and I don't understand why he's not at the forefront leading the charge, saying, hey, we have this massive overpayment that needs to be, that needs to be repealed, and I don't want to be closing post offices.
Right. My understanding from what I have heard Bernie say on this program, and this is purely my interpretation of it, I am in no way do I want to be putting words in his mouth, but my understanding, and also, just following the news on this, is that the law said that the Postmaster General has to do these things. This law that was passed in 2006 by the Republicans when they controlled Congress and the White House, this poison pill legislation. He had to set aside $5 billion a year. And this was right after, I don't know if you remember, 2004, 2005, the post office was showing such a profit. It was actually profitable that they were talking about redoing their entire fleet of vehicles and making them electric. And making it to help jumpstart the electric industry in the United States, the electric car industry, and how this could be, just transformational thing in the United States and everything. So the Republicans come along and say, now you've got to fund for the next 75 years, you've got to fully fund the health care retirement benefits of people who retire 75 years now, people who have not yet been born. And so the Postmaster General came in, and here's this law saying this is what he has to do. And so he set about doing it. He didn't see himself as the advocate. He's not the one who makes the laws. He's the one who has to execute the laws. The executive branch doesn't make law. It follows the law. It executes the law. And when Congress started leaning on him really hard, and Bernie was leading that charge, he started becoming more of an advocate for, changing things. In other words, he was going along with them. I think prior to that, he was just doing his job as it was defined. I agree. I would like to see the Postmaster General be more of an outspoken advocate. On the other hand, that isn't his job.
I do remember what you were saying about in 2004. I do remember that happening, which is all the more reason why, yes, he may have to do his job and do what he says, but he doesn't have to like it.
Please don't misunderstand me. I don't know the guy. I'm not defending him. I'm not attacking him, frankly. I don't know the details. What I do know is that what Bernie said today and what he said last week is that the Postmaster General has changed his opinion over time. And is working more collaboratively with the progressives in Congress than he had been before. I see that as a good step. I mean, it's beyond that. We're just going to have to see how this thing plays out. Thanks, Dan, for the call, and thanks for listening. Steve in Vancouver, Washington, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, so recently the GSA was in the news for having a little party down in Vegas.
Yeah.
That cost $800,000 or something.
Yeah.
And I have friends that always complain that I blame Bush for everything that goes wrong. And I don't blame Bush for everything that goes wrong, but I think we can blame Bush for this.
Okay. Are these GSA people who were hired during the Bush administration?
Absolutely. The Bush administration was told by the Heritage, I think it was the Heritage Foundation, to hire according to political loyalty, not competence. They put out.
Well, this wasn't. I don't think they needed anybody to tell them to do that. This was Karl Rove, running the Bush administration.
Yeah. And also during the Bush administration, something like 12,000 political jobs were turned into civil service jobs, where some jobs turn over with each administration. Civil service jobs, they get it.
Right.
So 12,000 people, 12,000, a certain level of bureaucracy now.
12,000 political appointees are now permanent bureaucrats in the Obama administration who were brought into the Bush administration because of their political loyalty to the Republican Party.
Correct. And we also know that the last year of the Bush administration, the head of the GSA, Loretta Doan, was investigated by Congress for violating the Hatch Act, which is she actually
That's
put
right.
together a presentation about how can we help our candidates.
Right. She had that whole PowerPoint presentation with charts and graphs and circles and diagrams and teaching people inside the GSA how to help out Republican candidates.
Right.
Yeah.
So we know the Bush administration had this culture of glorifying incompetence.
Right.
And those incompetent people have now reached to a certain level of bureaucracy. And that level of bureaucracy used to be political and used to be the people that could say, no, I don't think we need to spend this much money on a convention.
Right. Makes perfect sense, Steve. Thanks for sharing that with us. Makes perfect sense. This is the Republican strategy. Is fill government with incompetent people, screw things up, you know, Bush and Katrina, for example, and then blame government for it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And why would they do that? Because if you get government out of the way, there's lots of opportunity for billionaires and Romney rich to make a profit. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People of the United States of America. Indeed. Wendell in Palatine, Illinois. Hey, Wendell, what's up?
Hello, Tom. How you doing?
Great.
I know one way that we can stop Citizens United without even passing any laws or anything and go by what's on the book. Since they're saying that corporations are people, why don't the president sign an executive order that since they are people and Congress, Supreme Court said they are people, then one will make them pay the Social Security payroll taxes. make them pay the Social Security taxes take it
on all their income.
$100,000 and make it unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
Make unlimited Social Security taxes. And then also, because they're a person, they can't have their money overseas or nothing like that. They have to pay taxes on the money that they make overseas.
Yeah. There you go. There you go. Wendell, there are so many possibilities, and you've just touched on a couple of really good ones. Thank you for the call. So many possibilities to show how stupid. You can come up with more sophisticated words, but this Supreme Court decision was stupid. It was stupid. It was malicious. It was destructive. It was wrong. How stupid it was. Rodney in Chicago Heights. Hey, Rodney, what's up?
Let me kick you off. Hey, Tom, happy 420. Pack a wrap, my friend.
Well, thank you. Back to you.
Don't
bogart that joint.
Yeah,
what's
exactly.
up, Rodney?
I was watching Democracy Now! Today, and they had a very long segment with a former head technical director of the NSA, William Binney. Mm-hmm. And a couple other guests, but when you get a chance, check it out. But he said something, you know, that I thought when I first learned of it from the Democracy Now! A couple, 3 months ago, they had a reporter from Wired that was writing about their data.
You're talking about the NSA whistleblower?
Yeah, but their data storage facility out in Utah.
Right.
And he said something that I thought, you know, when I first heard of it, with all the information that they're gathering and storing, you know, that they could gin up any charge on any American that they wanted to, and that coupled with the indefinite military detention from the Defense Authorization Act, that is very frightening.
You know, that is to me, too. And let me take it a step farther. The way that democracies die and are replaced by totalitarian oligarchies is that everybody becomes a criminal. This is how, for example, in China, they did this for a long time. They may well still be doing it. There was a law that said that you could only leave your town. You could only move if you had permission from the state. And people, of course, as China industrialized over the last 30 years, people were moving like crazy and without permission. And so you had a situation, particularly in the larger cities and particularly among the workforce that had moved into those cities to be available, where everybody had committed a crime. And it was a crime with a rather substantial penalty, you know, years in prison. And so what the government could do then is they could identify whoever they wanted to to basically take out, identify the troublemakers, identify anybody who talks about unionization, identify anybody who talks to the press, identify anybody who says something that you don't like, and simply enforce the law that they had broken. Selective enforcement of the laws. So the first step is to make everybody a criminal. I am frankly concerned that, for example, our copyright laws are being used in this way. These draconian variations on the copyright laws that are being pushed by Hollywood and the record companies, and frankly by the Republicans and the big corporations, that and agreed to in many cases by Democrats, that would say that if you download something, and perhaps even unintentionally, or if you have a website and it gets on there, and this decision was just ruled on today, I believe it was. I read it on BBC, and on the BBC News site in Germany. They just ruled against YouTube, saying that YouTube, you know, they have to have control over their content. You know, it's their fault for having copyrighted material on their site. What that means is that if you have a website and somebody puts copyrighted material on it, you can be nailed. I've got a website. People can put material on it. You know, we try to prevent copyrighted material, but, you know, it could be up for 5 minutes, and all of a sudden, I'm a criminal. You're a criminal if you're trying to do that. And then they take people out. And it's just, you know, the first step is to create laws so that pretty much everybody can be a criminal, and then you start selectively enforcing those laws against the people you don't like. And it concerns me tremendously, Rodney, and thank you very much for the call. And if the NSA is doing the NSA has a mandate to look for bad guys. I'm with that. I think all of us are. On the other hand, we don't want to turn the United States into a police state, whether it's by virtue of the NSA or whether it's by virtue, frankly, of the copyright law. So I think that there's a whole variety of these things. George in Rockville, Maryland. Hey, George, what's up? George? Oh, we just lost George. George was listening on the Tom Hartman app. He must have pushed the wrong button on his iPhone. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
What's up, Tom? Hope you're doing well today on 420. And listen to this. We got chemicals being sprayed in the sky. I saw a documentary called What in the World Are They Spraying? I hope they show it on Free Speech TV. And it's talking about what you see in the sky is ordinary jet trails. But they're not. These jet trails actually stay for long periods of time, and they spread out and cover the sky with these high levels of barium, aluminum, and selenium. And
right.
They're making people, yeah.
This is because the engines are made out of that. And
well, what the thing is that these chemicals is actually under the science called geoengineering. Geoengineering is similar to what they did in Vietnam by spraying the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And what they're doing on the geoengineering, the scientists actually admit in this documentary, What in the World Are They Spraying? The scientists actually admit in doing this.
Yeah.
But they say that the science of the health risk have not, the analyzation of the health risk on the population has not yet been put together. So we find in the soil a higher level of alkaline and pH level in the soil is increased, and the crops are not growing the way they should.
Yeah. Well, and you think that that's because of aluminum coming out of aluminum jet engines and coming down to the earth. I get that, Michael. Michael, thank you very much for the call. If you want to look at, there's no technology that doesn't produce junk for our air. You could say the same thing about automobiles, right? The stuff that comes out of a tailpipe, you take three or four good breaths of it, you're toast. I don't see this as a giant conspiracy to poison us, although I do think that we should be looking more carefully at what's coming out of jet engines and what's coming out of cars. Diesel, I mean, diesel's incredibly toxic, you know, with all the particulate matter that comes out, so there's a lot of places we can look. John in San Luis Obispo, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? Hey, I just wanted to make a point. I'm not a Republican sympathizer by any means at all. I'm totally liberal. And I want to direct this towards Republican politicians, although there are many Republican entities and persons who support the ideas of, like, the Republican Paul Ryan budget,
mm-hmm.
Which tends to really punish the poor more than they already are. Well, I want to put out a message. I think it's the Republicans that actually live, these Republican politicians and those who support them through ALEC or whatever other way, Koch brothers, they're living in a poverty of their own, and it's sad. I don't think it's socio
empathic. I think it's they have a poverty of the soul.
Hmm.
They're just incapable of having any compassion or empathy for anyone except themselves and the people that, you know, continue to support what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, the Koch brothers. And I think that really deep inside, they're just sad and lonely because they have these strange views of, like, the Ayn Rand, the Paul Ryan thing.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Ayn Rand, I mean, you know, I think Ayn Rand was a certifiable sociopath. She based a couple of her novels on Wayne Edward Hickman, you know, a guy who was, you know, who was a mass murderer, not a mass murderer, but murdered a 12-year-old girl, cut her body up into pieces, and then ransomed it back to her father.
Sicker.
I mean, yeah, it's just downright bizarre. Interesting point, John. Thank you for calling and sharing it. Gary in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Sorry to hear about your dad, man. No wonder you have such passion, and you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
Just very quickly, you know, there's a lot of things to think about. I did like what Wendell's point on Citizens United, that if corporations are citizens, then they should pay all the same taxes that we citizens pay.
Well, and they should.
That was an interesting point.
And we should send them to death row from time to time.
Exactly. You know, killing people.
BP killed 11 people down in the Gulf. BP, Halliburton, and Transocean. Why are those corporations not sitting in a prison someplace?
Exactly. I agree. I just want to say one thing about these security guards, and then I'll let you go.
Yeah.
Okay, these security guards for the president. First of all, if your job is to protect the president, you should not be hanging out with people you do not know, male or female, friend or foe, or whatever the person is.
Yeah, I agree.
The days before the president is supposed to arrive. You know, wait a few weeks.
Yeah.
When you are done with your assignment.
No, you do it when you're on vacation if you're going to do it, you know?
Yeah,
so I'm hearing funny voices in my ear here, Jacob. I think the system has croaked. But Gary,
let me just add this very quickly.
Yeah.
I lived in Naples Island, Long Beach, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Bond, East Berlin, when the wall was still up, Barbados, Caribbean Islands. And I've had women who I thought were just talking to me and being friendly.
You're listening to Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And it turns out they were hookers, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this may be what happened, but still, they should have said no. I'm with you, Gary. Thank you.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Jacob Dean, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screeners, Paul Edney and Julie Lulley, our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the folks at the various companies that syndicate this program, Dow Global, Pacifica Radio, Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and others, Cable Radio Network, CRN, Don Rojas, Dennis Trunov, all the other great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for our tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. We wouldn't have it without you. Thank you so much. Mitch in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Mitch, what's on your mind?
Hey, greetings from the great, beautifully gray Pacific Northwest.
Okay. What's up?
Listen, I jumped back into the car just as you were making a statement earlier about how the Supreme Court decided that money was speech and not property.
Yes.
Well, if money is speech, how can you tax speech? Isn't speech supposed to be free?
Oh, that's an interesting one. Again, you know, you're pointing out how stupid the Supreme Court is.
I mean,
this, by the way, that started with the Buckley decision in the 1970s, Buckley versus Vallejo, and then got extended with First National Bank versus Bilotti in the 80s, as I recall. And
basically, what we're looking at now is you can't. If I follow out my logic, which may be very faulty, you can't tax me for any money I have, because that's just speech.
Maybe this is why Mitt Romney thinks that the 15% income tax rate that he pays on dividends should be zero. And all the Republicans, you know, they're running around going, that's double taxation. You shouldn't tax dividends because that's the profit that's distributed by corporations after they've already paid income taxes. Maybe that's, you know, hey, it's money, it's speech. It should be tax-free, right?
There you go.
The new rationale for the Republican wackadoodle economic, yeah, there you go. Mitch, thanks a lot for the call. That's a good one. I appreciate it.
Note for you, but
thank you very much. Doug in Phoenix. Hey, Doug, listening to KPHX. What's up, Doug?
Oh, not much, Tom. I have been talking with my dad a lot about the things that I've heard on your show.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing he always brought up by why he voted for Reagan was the subject of stagflation. I just have a couple questions.
Sure.
First, what is stagflation? How did we get it? And did Reagan's policies really get us out of the situation that we were back in the 70s?
Yes.
I'm going to take my answer off here.
Okay, that's fine. Well, you can hang on, Doug, if you have a further question. Let me just very quickly go through it. Stagflation is what happened at the tail end of the Nixon administration and through the Carter administration. It was referred to as stagflation, and it was a stagnant economy and high inflation. Around that time, Louise and I bought one of the first houses that we ever bought, and I remember 13-15%, something like that, for a mortgage, right? I mean, it was huge. Nixon had to do away with, there used to be a federal law that said you can't charge, banks can't charge more than, nobody could charge more than 10% interest, because that was considered usury, which is biblically usury is illegal, right? Charging too much interest. And Nixon had to blow off that 10% cap, because the interest rates had gone so high that, you know, you just couldn't have that law anymore. So you had this inflation that was, during the late Nixon years and throughout the Carter years, and you had a stagnant economy. They were both largely the result of the Vietnam War being paid for, and this was largely the fault of Lyndon Johnson, off the books, you know, with borrowed money and off the books in ways that it was largely hidden. In fact, he was using some of the Social Security funds to pay for the Vietnam War. And something that Reagan actually fixed. The Greenspan Commission, it was Greenspan and Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the former senator from wherever it was, Connecticut or someplace on the East Coast. They fixed the thing with Social Security and put it on a fairly stable course. And then Reagan got us out of and the Fed, by and large, got us out of the inflation by jacking the interest rates up so high that it just kind of squeezed down the money supply. Now, that was happening during the late Carter years. That was actually the therapy. So, you know, Reagan kind of inherited the benefit of that. But the way that Reagan booted the economy, got the economy going, what he claimed got it going was he cut the taxes on rich people. What he really did was he borrowed $3 trillion over an 8-year period and spent it. Now, if you borrow $3 trillion and spend it, and this was back in the days when $3 trillion was a lot of money, that would be like $6 or $8 trillion now. Just borrowed and spent, put on the national credit card without a penny of obligation beyond that. If you do that, you are going to stimulate the economy. And he spent a lot of it in the military, but he spent it in a lot of other ways, too, and hired a lot more federal employees. The government grew radically, dramatically under Reagan, and that's how he got us out of things. So, Doug, I hope that was useful and that explains the situation for you. And thanks so much for the call. I won't be here Monday or Tuesday. Carl Frisch is going to be filling in for me because Louise is going to be having surgery for breast cancer. The good news is that the lump they found is really small, and everyone is confident she's going to be fine. The bad news is she's going to be in for a few rough months. I only ask that you please keep her in your thoughts and your prayers. Send her some light. Her surgery is Monday morning. And please don't send emails of friendly or ideas or suggestions or anything, because we're buried in email and stuff like that. We've known about this for a few weeks. We've looked into all the available options. We're doing a lot of good things, and this is going to be great. This is going to be fine. I mean, Louise and I are going to be together when we're 90. We've been together since we were teenagers. It's been a long time, and it's going to continue to be. So just send light, love, and prayers, please. And Carl Frisch will be with us next week, and at least Monday and Tuesday. I'll be back Wednesday. So, and don't forget, democracy begins when you get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. See you next week.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.